Talk about that. All right, we are ready to kind of jump into the Kina of Kinat David itself, to the text. Last week we talked about the opening to Sukim by Konen David et Kina Azot Al Sha'ul Vayonatan Beno Vayomer Lelamed Bnei Yehuda Kasha Tinei Ketuvah Al Sefer HaYashar. We had a whole discussion about what the phrase means, jumping from the lament to the song about Shaul and Yonatan, and kind of this poetic language, and then jumping into the lesson of the Keshet and Sefer HaYashar. And at the end of our discussion, I suggested to you that that's really part of the introduction, that we are the Lamed Yehuda Keshet could refer to the archer and the bow in the military context, but it's also possible that it has much more of a Sefer Tehillim style introduction, the Lamed Bnei Yehuda Keshet, like the Keshet of the bow, referring to a musical instrument, and the Lamed Keshet is a kind of a phrase with which Tehillim might begin. Lamnatzeach ala Shminit, Lamed Keshet. We had various examples of that I showed you last week. And that Sefer HaYashar in that context may also refer to Sefer HaShira, or some kind of book related to song. The only other place Sefer HaYashar appears in Tanakh is in Sefer Yehoshua. And there too, it's in the context of a song that is sung, although there it's a song of victory and here it's a song of lament. But they share in common that sense of poetry and Shira. And so it's possible that that whole phrase, Lamed Bnei Yehuda Keshet, Yiktuva Sefer HaYashar, is all part of that introduction of Vayikonen et HaKina Hazot. Having said that, we are ready to jump into the text of the Kina itself. And what I want to do for our study of Kinat David is divide it into two parts. Today we're going to focus primarily on line by line the significance of each sentence and each pasuk in this Shira. And then, in our next class, which will be in 2 weeks, because I'm not here next week, I want to look at the whole structure of the Kina as a unit and see what we can learn from the structure overall of this poem. One of the most powerful, short pieces of poetry in Tanakh, famous because it's so often quoted and used in various ceremonies, military ceremonies, Yom HaZikaron, etc. Well known, but there's a lot of material here. There's a lot of substance. So we're going to work it through literally line by line. Starting with Pasuk Yud Tet. Hatzvi Yisrael al bamotecha chalal ech naflu giborim. I read it through once before, correct? We read it through the whole
you
thing?
You
read the whole thing?
Yes.
Kind of just to give us a picture, I'm going to do a quick summary of the whole thing, and then we're going to do it line by line. Hatzvi Yisrael al bamotecha chalal ech naflu giborim. Hatzvi Yisrael, we'll come back to the phrase, but it means essentially the choice of Israel, the best of Israel, who have fallen on the high places, how the mighty have fallen. Al tagidu begat, al tvasru b'chutzot Ashkelon. Don't tell them in the cities of Gat and Ashkelon. Pen tismachna benot plishtim, pen ta'alozna benot ha'arelim. Lest the daughters of the Philistines celebrate the death of Saul. Hare b'geboa al tal ve'al matar aleichem ustei trumot. Kind of a curse to the mountains of Geboa. They should not be dew or rain upon you and upon your fields. Kisham nigal magen giborim, magen Shaul b'limashiach b'shamen. For there, the shield of the mighty ones failed, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. Midam chalalim mechelev giborim, from the blood of the fallen ones, from the chelev of the heroes, the fat of the heroes. Keshet Yohanatan l'nasag achor, v'cherev Shaul lo tashuv rekam. The bow of Yonatan did not retract, did not fail, would not retreat. And despite all of the victims and fallen ones, midam chalalim, mechelev giborim, despite all of the tension around, nonetheless, and the sword of Saul did not return empty-handed. V'cherev Shaul lo tashuv rekam. Shaul v'Yonatan hane'avim v'ane'imim b'chayehem. Shaul and Yonatan loved and sweet in their lifetimes. U'v'motam lo nifradu, and not separated in death. Minisharim kalu me'arayot gaveru, faster than eagles, stronger than lions. Benot Yisrael el Shaul b'chena, daughters of Israel cry over Saul. Hamal bishchem shani im adanim, hamale adi zahav al levushchem, who brought you all of the spoils of war, the garments of red and gold. Ech naflu giborim betocha melchama, how could the mighty have fallen in war? Yonatan al bamatecha chalal, Yonatan on your high places has fallen. Tzarli alecha achi Yonatan, amtali ma'od, my angst, my pain to you, Yonatan, my brother, you are so sweet to me. Nifla'at avatcha li me'avat nashim, your love for me was more wondrous than the love of the women. Ech naflu giborim v'yavdu klei melchama, how the mighty have fallen and the war, or the tools of war, have been lost.
Keep repeating how the mighty have fallen.
Yes, that phrase is a key phrase that kind of structures the whole kina together. It's kind of like this refrain, Ech naflu giborim, not uncommon in poetry to have a kind of refrain or key phrase that sews together all the patches together, all the different pieces of it, and that's certainly the key phrase in this kina, Ech naflu giborim.
How the mighty fall.
Yes.
Is this like the origin of this?
This is it. There are a lot of idioms and expressions that come from Tanakh in general.
But Kinat David. Joy comes in the morning. I knew that was biblical.
But it's interesting because it's a really, it's not a religious thing. You know what I'm saying? You don't think it is being religious, but it is.
It is. Ech naflu giborim. Yeah. There's another phrase. There's a lot of, also in Avrachamim, which was composed specifically as a lament, as a kina for the fall of the communities of the Rhineland after the First Crusades. Avrachamim was written to weave together phrases from Kinat David. So the phrases such as Hane'avim v'ane'imim b'chayehem uv'matam lo nifradu, Ech naflu giborim, Nisharim kalu mi'arayot kaveru, these are all phrases that are built into the text of Avrachamim. And they are also sourced in this.
Also, Tefillat Chana takes a lot from earlier Tefillat.
Yeah, there's a theory to that effect. We don't know that for sure, but it's possible. It's a question which came first, Tefillat Chana or Tehillim. But
how do we explain David's great expressions of mourning for Shaul? So when he was so persecuted, I mean, why wasn't he
silent? So it's a really good question, and I'm going to hold on that question for another class 2 weeks from hence, because I really want to pick up that question when we look at the whole structure of the kina and the overall message of the kina. But you are essentially correct. Right? But it's not a surprise, though. David has always had extraordinary respect for Shaul as the anointed of God. Remember, the opportunities he had to kill Shaul and refused to do so, was angry at anybody who would. Right? When the Amalekite even claimed that he killed Saul, David killed him for it. Like David had a very powerful sense of respect for the dignity and position of the king. And ultimately, I think he also knew that Saul was not, in a certain sense, wasn't totally responsible for what he was doing, and we'll see that a little bit. It's hinted to here, where he really puts the blame for all of the years of the torment. I want to come back to that piece in a moment.
And it says so much for David.
Yeah, no question. It's an extraordinary tribute to the depth of David's understanding of the. Respect for Saul, and no question. But there's also Yonatan and the relationship with Yonatan. There's a lot of nuance in this kina, and Saul and Yonatan, the relationship between them. Yeah, there's a great deal of
and the office of the king.
Correct. when the Amalekite says that he killed Saul, so David's response is, "I'm killing your blood is on your head because you had the audacity to say that your mouth has convicted you by saying that I set forth my hand against the anointed of God." There's a certain you can't do that. Like that's the king is Mashiach Hashem. You have to respect that. All right, let's take this one step at a time. Let's go back to Pasuk Yud Tet. Hatzvi Yisrael Abamotecha Chalal. So first of all, the phrase Hatzvi Yisrael. It's going to take, this is going to be a lot of little pieces of detail, but it's important to kind of see the whole picture. Hatzvi Yisrael is trans... how do they translate it? Choice of Israel? Best of Israel?
Yeah.
The beauty?
Beauty? Oh, okay.
The beauty of Israel is
slain
upon
that. Yeah, the beauty of Israel, I don't know about the beauty. I think it's much more a function of the choice, the choicest, the best. The word tzvi...
Isn't it a deer?
So
a
the
deer?
Word in Hebrew, it can deer. Mean a deer, right?
Precious.
Can mean a deer.
Precious.
Here it's translated as precious. I think that's probably closer. The term is actually, in this context as it's used, is actually rooted in an Aramaic word, which is utsvi, tzadik bet yud, which means to choose. Appears in a number of different contexts. In Tanakh, it's almost always used as a description, with the exception of this one instance, it's used in the context of a description of the land of Israel. And I give you all the references, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Daniel, actually, in that context, it's the Mashiach, the one who is anointed by God, or the one who will emerge, is the one chosen by God, litzvi ulechavod, for honor and for glory. But if you look at Yirmiyahu, Perek Gimel, source 2. I'll give you a land of desire, the inheritance of tzvi. Now, if you translate inheritance of deer, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because it's a parallel to chemda. Eretz chemda, nachalat tzvi. Similarly, in Yechezkel, most famous expression, as it's used, "Byom ahu nesati ati lehem lo tziam me'eretz Mitzrayim al eretz asher taiti lehem zavat chalav u'dvash tzvihi lechol ha'aratzot." Land of Israel, flowing with milk and honey, the choicest of all of the lands, the land that I have chosen, the most precious, chosen of all of the lands. Similarly, in Daniel, stood in the land of the of choice. So the phrase Tzvi Yisrael is like the Nivchar, the choicest, the one chosen to be above all others, is probably the best translation. And in this case, he's talking about Shaul, of course, and Yonatan, Tzvi Yisrael, who were chosen to be the king and the heir to the throne. Right? The king of Israel is the one who is chosen to be above all the others. And yet, al bamotecha chalal, on your bama, you have fallen. What's a bama?
It's like a platform?
It can be a high place, a platform, right? Like a bima, but it's also
it's like
in this context...
Mizbeach,
so a mizbeach is called the bama, a high place is called the bama, and there are a number of references to the world of korbanot, the world of the mikdash, in this kina. So in addition to the phrase abamatecha chala, which appears twice, you also have dam chalalim, the blood of the fallen, chelev giborim, and dam and chelev are certainly phrases that come from the world of the korbanot. Yonatan abamatecha chalal, the notion that they have fallen as korbanot, the sacrifices. Right? In modern Hebrew, somebody who's fallen in battle is called, we call them krav is a battle, but we use the same phrase in modern Hebrew, the korbanot, right? Those who have fallen, sacrificed themselves for in battle. it's the same terminology, and again, it's the first place you find the use of the term to describe those fallen in battle as korbanot al bamatecha, or fallen on the bama, is here in this kina, and I think it reflects the depth of the pain, the sense that it's a sacrifice for the betterment of the Jews. They've given their lives on behalf of Klal Yisrael, their korban. The korbanot, the parallel to the world of the Mikdash, which is certainly part of David's world view, the world of the Mikdash, which he dreamt about. So all of that is reflected in these very choice words. Right? Tzvi Yisrael, also even the phrase Tzvi Yisrael, what kind of animal is brought as a korban? Different kinds of species, but what kind of animal? Pure animal, the best of the animals, right? If you go back to the story of Cain and Hevel, right? The whole issue of whether did you bring just a korban or your best of the korban, right? There's an element of Hatzvi Yisrael, the best of the best has fallen here. And that's what a korban, you want a korban to be the best of the best, not a secondary animal you don't need anymore, so you throw it out and give it to the Mizbeach. But no, on the contrary, you put the best on the Mizbeach, if you will. Hatzvi Yisrael al bamatecha chala. The choice, the best of Israel, has fallen upon the Bama. Ech naflu giborim. The mighty, the powerful, how they have fallen. That's Pasuk Yutet. He goes back and forth here between the kina for Yishaul and Yonatan and other players in the story. So he talks about Benot Plishtim, he'll talk about Benot Yisrael very soon. It's sort of contrasting the world of Shaul and Yonatan on the battlefield to the world around them.
That's like the chorus.
I don't know if it's a chorus, but it's certainly a contrast.
I'm just saying, like, the Greeks would have the chorus, and now we have
I don't think that's who he's talking about, but maybe we'll come to it in a second. Pasuk Chaf, Al tagidu bagat, al tivaslu b'chutzot Ashkelon. Don't tell them in Gat or in Ashkelon. Gat and Ashkelon, of course, are
Plishtim. Eretz Plishtim.
Are Eretz Plishtim. Don't tell them. Now, of course, they're going to find out. No question. Right? You can't.
First of all, they were there.
Well, the Plishtim were up north. Gat and Ashkelon are south.
How long is that going to take?
Right. So I'm saying, of course, they're going to find out. But in the context of the poetry, he's saying, don't tell them. Just hide it from them. Why give them the opportunity to gloat? Right? Pen tismachna benot plishtim, pen ta'alozna benot ha'arilim. Because all they'll do is gloat. The daughters of the plishtim, the daughters of these uncircumcised Philistines, right? They're just going to gloat. Why give them that opportunity to gloat? Now, of course, they did. They took the head of Saul, cut it off his body, and took it down to the temples and were celebrating.
And that's what he was afraid of.
And that's what he was afraid of. I'm not even sure he didn't already know that was going on. Mm-hmm. It's possible. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that you feel the angst, right? You feel the pain. And don't tell them. Don't let them hear about it, because we know how much they will taunt us, how much they will celebrate, and how disrespectful that celebration will be. Pen tismachna benot plishtim, pen ta'alozna benot ha'arelim. Right? These cheerleaders, if you will, of the plishtim, who are going to celebrate. Now, there's two issues with this reference to the plishtim. Number one is, this we've seen before, a constant reference to the plishtim as the arelim. We've seen this many times back from Sefer Shoftim days, when Shimshon goes running to the Philistines and his daughters and his parents say to him, and I put the source on the page, in source 5, Vayomer lo aviv imo, ha'em bibnot achecha v'chol ami isha ki ata olech lekachat isha miplishtim ha'arelim. You don't have enough Jewish girls, you have to go run after an uncircumcised Philistine. Now, circumcision is irrelevant to the females, right, of course. But the category of the entire people as one who are uncircumcised is a kind of a pejorative statement about the Plishtim overall. It's also possible, we don't have a lot of evidence this, but it's also possible that, remember, the Plishtim are not indigenous to the region. Right? The Plishtim are essentially an import from Crete, really. And there's a discussion about that in Sefer Amos. The Semitic cultures of Mesopotamia may have had much more of a propensity towards circumcision than the European sourced culture and migrants who came. So there's some discussion as to whether or not that the other Semitic cultures at the time, Midian and others, may in fact have been or had a culture of circumcision, and in that regard the Plishtim did not.
So would the reason for their circumcision have been?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the religious one, but culturally. Okay. So that's just a reference, an observation that the Plishtim are always identified as Arelim. We saw it in Shmuel, even Shaul's last words to we saw it by Yonatan, but we also saw it in Shaul's last words to his Na'ar, when he said, "Pen yavo ha'arelim ha'ele," with the karuni.
But it's always in a derogatory.
It's always in a derogatory, right? Because the Plishtim were your arch enemy. So it's like not uncommon. You want to talk about the Plishtim. This is a different world. And they were cruel. Right? They were not just our enemy, they were a cruel enemy. So it was not an uncommon kind of burst. But the other piece of this is a reference that will come back for us very importantly later on in the kino. Who are these Benot Plishtim? Right. Why is there an assumption that suddenly there's going to be these Benot Plishtim singing and dancing? Right. Who are these daughters who are singing and dancing? And the answer is an obvious one. Right? It was not uncommon. We've seen it now several times. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon in the victory march of battle for there to be a group of, we want to call them as chorus, but I think that comes much later, right? That's much more in a play context, right? But a group of women who would come out and greet with song and dance, right? Betupimu v'mcholot, the dancing in Shiloh, the dancing in Shirat, the dancing after battle, right? The dancing in Shiloh, you have the dancing of Miriam in Shirat Hayam. Right. You have not an uncommon phenomenon to have daughters of Israel or daughters of any culture, right, come and celebrate the victory. And we're going to come momentarily to the Benot Yisrael, who had a similar role in the context of Sefer Shmuel and throughout Tanakh. So it was not uncommon. We saw this also in...
When you have it in the Tefillot of Shabbos, V'tismachnu Benot Yehuda.
V'tismachnu Benot Yehuda, correct. And you have it also in a little bit, possibly, the reference in Yiftach. Because when Yiftach makes the reference to the one who will come out to greet me from my house.
Another happy story.
But again, one who comes out to greet me from my house was not expecting it to be an animal. It was expecting it to be a person. The question is to whom they were coming and greeting and who they were singing to. Right? But there was an understanding that out of the, when you return home from victory, and from battle, there is a greeting of the women who come to celebrate and to sing that kind of victory. So in this case, he's talking about Benot Plishtim, Benot Ha'arelim, and they're the ones who would naturally be there to sing and to acknowledge and to celebrate. And David says, don't even tell them. Right? Don't even tell them. Al tagidu bagat. Al tivasu b'chutzot Ashkelon. Why? Pen tismachna benot ha-plishtim, pen talozna benot ha-areli. All right. Chav Aleph. That was a very challenging pasuk. Hare b'goboa al tal ve'al matar alechem ustei trumot. Ki shem nig'al magen giborim magen Shaul b'li Mashiach b'shamen. Lashes out his anger at Hare Goboa. As if to curse them. Mountains of Gilboa, I curse you, no dew, no rain upon you, or upon your fields. Right. The clear as a...
What did Mount Gilboa do?
It's a mountain at the end of the day. There, the
shield of... That was the final resting place.
Yeah, but okay, but still, it's a field. It's
not the mountain's fault. No, but I'm saying, in Tanakh, you always have these things. Look, oh heavens, and see all earth.
Yeah, but that's not Hare. He's not blaming the heavens.
But I'm just saying, sometimes these places, the place is used as almost like a character.
Yeah, but
Hare Gibbon is pretty strong, isn't it?
Right. There's a sense. Of, look at the Rabag. Again, it sends us in a direction, but it's we need to finish it. Source 8. Hare Gibbon Kilel Harim Hahem. Ba'avur shekara behem ma shekara mi'amikre haraze. Curse the mountains. Why? Because on those mountains occurred this terrible calamity. Which I get on a certain level, right? You want to curse the mountain, but at the end of the day, what do the mountains have to do with that? How could they have prevented it? I could live with it as is. I could just, that's what the Rabbag says. He's lashing out. So he lashed out at Benot Plishtim, he's lashing out at Hare Gibbon, and then he'll lash out at Benot Yisrael, and he's kind of thrusting his... But there may be something deeper here, and this I heard from Rav Meidan. I thought it was a very creative possibility, that on a certain level, David expected Hare Gibbon to behave differently. What does that mean? How did mountains behave differently? So remember that the battle of Shaul in Har Gilboa, or Har Gilboa, it's a mountain range, so it's called Har Gilboa. Right? The battle of Shaul is taking place at exactly the same time as the battle of David and Ziklag against the Amalekim. Okay, it's the exact same moment, almost. Certainly within the same day. Correct?
Yeah.
Let's go back to Prakim, to Perek Lamed, which again is the exact same moment as the battle in Hare Gibbon. Take a look at Pasuk Chet. We'll start with Pasuk Chet. Perek Lamed, Pasuk Chet. Vayish'al in Shmuel Aleph. Vayish'al David b'Hashem l'mor, erdof acharei ha'gedud hazeh, asigenim. Should I go and chase this gedud? Am I going to catch up to them? Vayomer lo erdof, ki aseg tasig v'etzel tatzil. God said to him, go, chase them, you will be successful. Vayelech David hu v'shesh miot isha sherito. David and his 600 men start to pursue. Vayavo ad nachal habsor. And they come into this vadi, this nachal called nachal habsor. Vahanotarim amadu. And the remainder stood behind. Vayadov David hu v'abamiot ish. So he went on with 200. Vayamdu matayim ish. But 200 got left behind. Why? Asher pigru me'avor et nachal b'sor. Because they were too late to cross nachal b'sor. What was going on here? 400 had managed to cross nachal b'sor, but 200 didn't.
This English says they were too weak to go over.
Too weak?
Yep, that's the translation.
Asher pigru me'avor nachal b'sor. 200, I can't imagine 200 men of David, 600 warriors would be weak. In any level. What does it say over there?
Exhausted.
Fager is to remain is to fall behind. I different theory.
Could the water have gotten too
right.
high?
Right. You ever cross like a vadi, you ever cross a nachal, mm-hmm. right? These flash floods come quickly. We're down right. in the south. We're down in the Negev. Right. These flash mm-hmm. floods come quickly. Mm-hmm. All you need is
rain.
A little rain. A little rain comes, and suddenly... Mm-hmm. You can't cross
right.
because a very dry riverbed can suddenly become an impassable
flood.
So David is on the run. He's chasing after Amalek. And in the midst of this pursuit, Nachal Besor becomes impassable. So 400 managed to cross, and 200 got caught behind. Why? No idea. But the most likely explanation is
they were spread out. Right?
It's a Nachal. It's a Nachal. A Nachal can become flooded any moment.
Right.
All you need is a little rain. Correct?
Yeah.
Now, rain is not an uncommon phenomenon in the land of Israel. But rain also has a unique ability in battle to change the tide. Sorry, that was a bad pun. Right? Not intended. Right? But to change the character of a campaign, miraculously. Even to the point of giving advantage to the very significant smaller army. Most famous of those of that type of battle in which the rain literally changed the course of the campaign is the battle of Devor and Barak against Sisera. Now, what happened in the battle of Devor and Barak against Sisera? That was in Sefer Shoftim.
I only got in the middle. I only came in the middle of Shoftim. I missed the beginning.
You have to catch up. All right, I have to catch up. Take a look at Perek Shoftim, Perek Dalid and Hay. Battle of Devor and Barak is an interesting battle. You have Sisera and his army of 900 chariots parked in the valley of Emek Yisrael. We've talked a number of times, we've talked about the fact that Emek Yisrael is a strategic
crossing point
and a critical piece of land bridge in the Middle East, in Israel in particular. He who controls Emek Yisrael controls the country. Modern Israel is essentially more or less south of Emek Yisrael, but ancient Israel was half south, and Emek Yisrael is right in the middle, because it goes all the way up into Eretz Naphtali and Asher. So Emek Yisrael is literally smack in the middle of the country, or more or less in the middle of the country. And Sisera, general of Yavim Melech Knaan, is sitting in Emek Yisrael with 900 chariots, horses, chariots, swordsmen, riders, you name it, an army of extraordinary power. Pasuk Gimel. Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael l'Hashem ki tshameot rechev barzel lo. Ulechatzet b'nei Yisrael b'chozka 20 shana.
Wait, where are we?
Shoftim Perek Dalet.
Okay, but I'm
gonna it's page 296.
We're gonna bunch of stuff. Okay. Bunch. Hang on a second. So 900 chariots is sitting in Emek Yisrael, oppressing Israel for over 20 years. Devorah is the Neviah, Barak is the general in charge of the army. They decide to go into battle. Skip to Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayazek Sisera et kol rechbot shamiot rechev bazel et kol ha'am asher ito mechoroshet ha'goyim el nachal kishon. Sisera takes his 900 chariots and brings them down into the heart of Nachal Kishon. Nachal Kishon is the great Nachal that runs again in the land of in Emek Yisrael. Ostensibly, I assume it's the middle of the summer. It's dry riverbeds. Vatomer Devorah Barak. Devorah turned to Barak and said, "Kum, get up. Ki zeh hayom asher natan Hashem et Sisera b'yadecha. Because this is the day that God will give you Sisera into your hands." Barak has an army of 10,000 soldiers. Sisera has an army of 900 chariots and thousands upon thousands of soldiers, more than can be counted. Halo Hashem yetzal lefanecha, God has gone out before you. Vayered Barak mehar tavor v'aseret alfim ish acharav. Vayahom Hashem et Sisera v'et kol arechev v'et kol ha'machane lefi cherev lifnei Barak. God confounded the army, the chariots, and the horses of Sisera, who fell before Barak. Vayered Sisera mi'al merkava, vayanos beraglav. Sisera got off his chariot and ran by foot. And the rest of the story is how Barak pursued him. Unclear what it was that Devorah said when she said to him, "Now go, because God has given you this people, this army into your hands." Unclear what it was that confounded the horses and the chariots, that so confused them, and that ultimately forced Sisera to get off his chariot and run by foot, which is basically the end of his campaign. However, what is unclear in Perek Daled becomes clearer when you look at the references to the same battle in Shirat Devorah. So if you turn to Perek He, I'm just doing a quick review of stuff we learned back in Perek when we did Shoftim the first time. Take a look at Pasuk. Pasuk Yud Tet. Perek Hey, Pasuk Yud Tet. Ba'u Melachim Nilchamu. Kings came to wage war. Az Nilchamu Malchei Knaan B'Tanach Ame Megiddo. Then the kings of Knaan fought in this battle in the cities of Tanach and Megiddo. Betzakesev Lalakachu, they weren't mercenaries, they came to fight, ideological fight against Israel. And we fought back. How did we fight back? Min Shemayim Nilchamu. The heavens fought for us. Now the heavens fought for us could simply mean
Hashem was with us.
But in this case, she makes reference to a much more specific context. Remember, how do foot soldiers on the tops of a hill overcome a army of 900 chariots and horses fill and thousands upon thousands of soldiers? Hakochavim mimesilotam nilchamu im Sisera. The stars in their courses, in their course, in their mesila, in their trajectories, they fought with Sisera. How do stars fight with Sisera? Right? The stars are aligned, hence the expression, right? The stars are aligned. But in this case, a much more profound issue. Right? The key to what's the weakest part of a tank?
Treads.
The treads. What's the weakest part of a chariot? The
wheels.
The wheels and the horse. Take out the horse, you take out the motor. Right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't take much to frighten a horse.
Mm-hmm. Just a coffee cup.
A coffee cup?
You know, horses in New York was they always freak out with the empty coffee.
Oh yeah, no, I did not know that. But certainly, a show of shooting stars, as the Mefarshim describe it, right? A show of a meteor shower, or a show of shooting stars, could certainly set the horses on edge. Kochavim mimesilatam nilchamu im Sisera, and then nachal kishon grafam. Nachal Ktumim Nachal Kishon. Nachal Kishon swallow them up. This ancient brook, this ancient river. Nachal Kishon, Nachal Ktumim. Meaning?
Flash flood.
Right? How does a Nachal to confound them? Mm-hmm. So you get a flood, you get a freak shower in the middle of the spring, mm-hmm. and suddenly, right, Sisera goes down to the, takes his army down into the middle of the Nachal, because the dry Nachal, and within minutes, the Nachal becomes
mm-hmm. river. Sweep them away.
Right? Or it becomes flooded, or becomes moist, and becomes muddy. Right? Mm-hmm. Now you've taken out the horses with the star, with shooting stars, and you take out the wheels of the chariots with the mud. And you have a very similar scenario to what you had in Kriyat Yamsuf. Mm-hmm. Right? Which is why the references here to Kriyat Yamsuf, a Yahom Machane Mitzrayim, a Yahom Sisera, right, are very similar. Come back to the story of David. David comes to Nachal Besor, and Nachal Besor suddenly becomes impassable in the middle of the pursuit. Why? Because it rained. What would have happened, theoretically? Remember, the Plishtim are an army of chariots. That's why they're on the coast. Army of chariots and horses. Shaul is an army of foot soldiers. What would have happened in Shaul's world, in the Battle of Har Gilboa, if it had rained? if
would have been a lot better for
right?
Shaul.
If what would have if what happened to Devorah and Barak would have happened to Shaul. Mm-hmm. And here's David in Siklag chasing after the Plishtim and gets caught at Nachal Besor because on the same day because it
rained
because it flooded. And you have to wonder if deep down in David's heart he's hoping, because he knows that that the Plishtim are going up north. He knows the Plishtim are going to fight against Shaul, right? That he had gone with them and then turned back. If Nachal Besor flooded, can you imagine it's just this glimmer of hope that maybe, just maybe, Emek Yisrael, Har Gilboa, maybe Emek Yisrael could flood. Maybe Nachal Kishon could flood. Maybe a little rain on Har Gilboa could have changed the dynamic of the entire battle.
But it's still.
But here, the rain in the south. Why couldn't it have rained in the north?
But it makes it sound like it's the mountain's fault. Mm-hmm. The way the Kena says
but
it's
not
it
about
the
mountain's
like
fault.
It's
not about the mountain's fault. It's not about fault. It's about why suddenly is rain a factor? Why does he turn his focus on the mountain of Gibeah and say, "Don't rain"? It's not about fault. Mm-hmm. It's about the understanding of the poetry. What was it in the story that, of all of the concepts, why would he turn to rain on Har Gibeah? Right. What's it's not about fault. It's about the rain. Out of the blue, you pull out an imagery of, okay, Har Gibeah should never rain on you anymore. Why not? Because we had the rain down in the south. It's what saved us. It's what enabled us to catch up with the Amalek. Would that it have rained on Har Gibeah would have changed the whole tide. Would have changed the whole story. Would that it have rained on Har Gibeah? It didn't. We got the rain. They didn't get the rain. We were saved. They weren't. You can hear the challenge. You can hear the angst. He's down in Nachal Besor and got caught by this rain. And in the end, probably Amalek did too, which is why he was able to catch up to Amalek. And yet up in the north, it didn't. And so he turns to Har Gibeah and he says, Har Gibeah, I'll tell Valmatar. What you would that you would have had rain to?
Well,
imagine that would have been.
I mean, Hashem is the cause of it.
I understand that, but that's not the issue. It's not a theological issue. It's not about the theology of it. It's about the emotion of it. It's poetry. It's about recognizing the jump, the contrast, the parallel. Here he is in Nachal Besor, and there's rain there. Now that there's an element of hope. Dashed. Hare Gibeah, Al Tal Ve'Almatar.
So it represents dashed hope.
I think there's a contrast between what happened to him in the south and what happened to what you had hoping would have happened to Shaul as the one possible mechanism that could have saved or could have changed the outcome of the battle. And then, hang on 1 second, let me just finish the phrase. Kisham nigal gimagen giborim again Shaul b'li Mashiach b'shamen. That's a more complicated phrase. Magen Shaul, the shield of Saul. B'li Mashiach Pashamen. So a simple explanation is that the shields would have been kind of smeared with oil in order to make them slippery, in order to make the enemy's swords or
spears
kind bounce off or slide off of them. Mm-hmm. So his shield failed. Mm-hmm. So his shield failed as if to say it wasn't anointed well enough with oil. But there's also the irony of referring to Shaul as B'li Mashiach B'Shamen. Right? Here is the Mashiach, but Shaul as the Mashiach Hashem, and yet he fell in battle. And so he's no longer the anointed, right? He's no longer has that title because he has fallen in battle. So there's an element of that as well. Yeah, you had a question.
When you're talking about Al Tal V'Almatar, that really just makes me keep thinking about Zvi's question about why David, I know you're going to address it, but why David has this angst so about Shaul?
The whole thing is about Shaul and Shaul and Yonatan. The whole thing is about Shaul, the whole kin is about Shaul and Yonatan. We'll come back to it. He's no question. His hope was that Shaul would survive, and last hope that gets dashed. No question.
But why is he saying it sounds like in the future there should be no Tal or
Matar? Yeah, he's that's the poetry of it. That's the moment. Right? That's his cry out.
So it shouldn't be now.
That's his cry out. Mm-hmm. It's you have to in poetry. You have to think. You can't think rationally in poetry. It's poetry, right? You have to think.
He's lamenting.
You have to think poetically. All right, Pasuk Chaf Bet. מדם חללים מחלב גיבורים, קשת יונתן לא נסג אחור, וחרב שאול לא תשוב ריקם. So this we talked about a little bit before. We talked about the keshet, the bow and arrow of Yonatan. Right? We've seen the bow and, we've seen Yonatan with the bow and arrow. Remember the moment that David is hiding from Shaul and Yonatan, and he come up with a plan to reveal to David what Shaul's intent really was back in Perek Chaf, I think it was, or Yotet, and he shoots arrows. Right. Yonatan is a Yonatan is an archer. Right? Yonatan is Shevet Binyamin. Yonatan is an archer. On the other hand, Shaul, we also saw Shaul is never far from his cherev or chanit, his sword or his spear. Now, it's an interesting twist because the typical trade of war of Shevet Binyamin is the archer is the bow, and of Shevet Yudah is the sword. In Shaul's case, it's a little bit of a twist because Shaul is the is uniquely identified with the sword or the spear, cherev or chanit. But I think it's a reflection of the fact that Shaul was so tall. Mm-hmm. And Shaul was shichmo v'mal gavoh mikol adam. And Shaul was extraordinarily tall. Height plays a factor in battle. It allows you to reach to especially as a swordsman. It allows you to reach out at a distance that your enemy can't. So it gives you a distinct advantage in battle. That's what probably made Shaul such a formidable warrior with the sword. Because he had that advantage of height and breadth. So here he talks about the strength, the courage of Yonatan and Shaul, who bow did not retreat from battle, keshet Yonatan la nasagachor, and the sword of Shaul that never fell empty-handed, cherev Shaul la tashuv rekam, and yet were unable to succeed in battle. All right, brings us to the two most critical psukim in this kina, pasuk chav, start with chav gimel. Shaul v'Yonatan, haneavim v'aneimim b'chayehem, v'motam lo nifradu, Minisharim kalu me'arayot gaver. Shaul and Yonatan, beloved and sweet in their lifetime, not separated in their deaths. And here's sort of the beginning of the conversation of the relationship between Shaul, between David and Shaul and Yonatan in particular, because now he turns his attention to Yonatan, and he'll pick up on Yonatan in particular. You'll see in pasuk chaf hey, Ech naflu giborim b'toch mechama Yonatan abamatecha chalal Ech tzali alecha achi Yonatan. Okay, so at this point, it shifts his focus from Shaul to Yonatan. And his relationship with Yonatan in particular is very powerful. There's a very personal lament in the loss of Yonatan. Their relationship is deep. Their friendship is true. It goes all the way back to the very first time that David appears in Sefer Shmuel Aleph. And I gave you a couple of references to kind of trace the story, but starting in Source 9, Perek Yerchet, after the battle of Goliath, Veikichalato ledaber Shaul, veNefesh Yonatan nikshera beNefesh David veYaveu Yonatan kinafsho. Very deeply connected, sort of on a spiritual level, on a soul level, veNefesh Yonatan nikshera beNefesh David. They shared a common world view that even Shaul did not share. Right, this sense that God, this faith in God in the midst of battle, the ability to even the minority can fight against the majority if they have Hashem with them on their side. Right? The David against Goliath and the Yonatan against the Netziv Plishtim. Right? There's a certain common warrior blood, if you will, that connects them together. If you look at Pasuk, look at Source 10. When Shaul demonstrates his anger and his desire to kill David, and Yonatan finally sees it, הנער בא ודוד קם מאצל הנגב ויפול לאפיו ארצה וישתחו שלוש פעמים וישקו איש את רעהו. They hugged each other, they kissed each other, ויפקו, they cried, איש את רעהו. They cried on each other's shoulders as they were departing now, because David was going to have to flee for his life. And so they cried together. Ad David higdil. David cried more. Vayomer Yonatan leDavid, lech l'shalom. Yonatan says to David, go in peace. Ashenishbanu shneinu anachnu b'shem Hashem lemo Hashem yeh b'ni u'v'necho v'en zari v'en zarecha ad olam. They take an oath in God's name that their friendship would endure for eternity. Vayakom ha'yelech v'yonatan ba'ir. David had to flee, and Yonatan returned to his city. Similarly, in Shmuel Aleph Perek Chaf Gimel, you find that time when they in En Gedi, and in the David is in hiding, and Shaul is running after him, and Yonatan runs ahead, finds David, and says to him, "Vayakom Yonatan ben Shaul vayelech al David chosha," comes to him in secret. Ve'chazek et yado be'elokim, and he strengthens him, he encourages him. Ve'yomrei lav al tira, don't be afraid. This is Yonatan speaking to David. Ki lo timtzacha yad Shaul avi, my father is not going to catch you. Ve'ata timlocha Yisrael, I know that you will be the king of Israel. Ve'anochi yelecha lemishna, and I will be happy to be your second. Remember, they were brothers-in-law. I forget that they were brothers-in-law, right? He married Michal. V'gam Shaul avi yodea ken. My father knows this too. Ve'yichlatu shnehem brit lifnei Hashem, ve'yeshev David b'chosha. They made a brit. David remained there in Chosha. Yonatan alach leveto, and Yonatan returned home. The Mishnah Pirkei Avot identifies the relationship between Yonatan and David as a classic example of a unique relationship. The Mishnah says, very famously, Kol ahava shehi tliya b'davar batel. Batel davar batla ahava. Any love, any emotional attachment that is dependent upon a thing, right? Then if that matter or that thing no longer exists, then the relationship is batel as well. Whereas v'she'enat liya b'davar, but a love or a relationship that is independent of a thing, einab tila l'olam, can endure forever. Example, eizuhi avat liya b'davar, what kind of love that is dependent upon something, and in this case a physical attachment, zu avat Amnon v'tamar. We'll get to the story of Amnon and Tamar, comes a little bit later in this text, in Sefer Shmuel. But v'she'enat liya b'davar, a love that is pure, that is not dependent upon any matter, zu avat David v'yonatan. That's the relationship between David and Yonatan. And you certainly feel that in the lament here, Shaul v'yonatan, ha'ne'avim ba'ne'imim b'chayim uv'matam la'nifratu, tzar li alecha achi Yonatan. My pain for you, my brother, Yonatan. Having said that, there is a certain, how should I describe it? There is a certain irony or a certain challenge or pain that is tugging at David's heart. Meaning, if you look at Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Shaul v'Yonatan ha'ne'avim b'ha'ne'imim b'chayehem u'matam lo nifradu. Shaul and Yonatan, beloved and sweet in their lifetime and in death not separated. What does it mean u'matam lo nifradu? They died together in Har Gilboa. And therefore, of course they died together in Har Gilboa. They went to battle in Har Gilboa. That was the fate, to die together in Har Gilboa. What's the significance?
I think the whole idea that David when Yonatan confirmed that Shaul really wants to kill David, instead of going with him, he stayed.
There's a tragedy that sort of permeates the story of David and Yonatan. Because at the critical moment of David's life, David finds himself alone. Mm-hmm. And the people who are there who to support him and to be with him and who save his life, but there are people surrounding him that are part of Shaul's circle. And ultimately, they choose to remain with Shaul and not to join David. So at those critical moments, David found himself alone. The first to, in a sense, disappoint him was Michal, because Michal warns him, frees him, lets him go, saves his life, but then she remains with her father. And she becomes known as Shaul Bat, right, Michal Bat Shaul. She remains with Shaul. Now, she had reason to remain with Shaul. She didn't have to. She could have gone with David. And Yonatan in particular had that moment where he could have gone with David. He had a choice to make. And at the end of Source 10, where that first moment, Vayishku Yisrael, Vayivku Yisrael, they kissed each other, they hugged each other, they cried on each other's shoulders, Ad David Igdil. Except that David cried more. Why did David cry more?
He was the one who was alone. Right?
Because he's the one who has to run. And Shaul and Yonatan chose to return to Shaul. And that's the irony of Pasuk Aleph, the end of that paragraph, Perachav Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, Vayakom Vayelech, David got up and ran, V'Yonatan Bahayir. But Yonatan went back to the city. Or at the end of Source 11, they make a brit, they swear loyalty to each other. V'Yonatan alach leveto. Each of these moments where they meet ends with Yonatan goes back to Shaul.
And David's alone.
And David remains alone. And when he dies with Shaul. And so that kind of that pain, mm-hmm. I think, is reflected in Pasuk of Gimel, Shaul V'Yonatan, and he's trying to lament them in a positive way, right? Shaul V'Yonatan, loved and sweet and in their lifetime and not separated in death, quicker than eagles, swift, mightier than lions, min sharim karlu me'arayot kaveru, right? Ech neflu giborim betoch ha'mochama Yonatan, abba matach ha'chalal, tzar li alech achi Yonatan. But then his lament turns to Yonatan. Why? Because Yonatan chose to cast his lot with Shaul and not with David. And the end result was that Yonatan fell with Shaul. And that's the deepest pain in this. Right? There's a national tragedy, which is Shaul, and then there's the personal tragedy, which is Yonatan. I think that's reflected here as well. All right. Last two issues in this Kina, Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Benot Yisrael El Shaul Bechena. Daughters of Israel, cry for Saul. Hamalbishchem Shanim Adanim Amale Adi Zahav Al Levushchem. Saul, the warrior, brought you all the spoils of war, the garments of red and clothing of gold and jewelry of gold to wear on your garments. Adi Zahav Al Levushchem. So cry for him. Benot Yisrael o Shaul Bechena. There's two ironies in this pasuk. Irony number one is outside of Shaul, Yonatan, and David were the three major people in this kina, and outside of the inanimate Harei Gilboa, right? The only two other groups of people mentioned specifically are
Bnei
Plishtim and Bnei Yisrael. Okay, so in Pasuk Chaf, he talks about Bnei Plishtim, and in Pasuk Chaf Dalet, he talks about Bnei Yisrael. To Bnei Plishtim, he says, don't even tell them why, because they're going to sing. And to Benot Yisrael, he says, it's time for you to cry. Benot Yisrael, El Shaul Bechena. It's time for you to cry for Shaul. Now, that's one irony. Okay, well, not an irony as much as a structure of the kina is designed to contrast Benot Yisrael with Benot Plishtim. Benot Plishtim are celebrating. We don't want them to celebrate, but they are. Benot Shaul, Benot Yisrael he instructs them to cry. El Shaul Bechena. Amal Bishchem Shani Im Adanim Amale Adi Zahav Al Bishchem. Now, the irony, or the satire, if you will, or the cynicism, it's a better word, the cynicism in this pasuk, is why are not Israel instructed to cry? Because we lost the king of Israel, because we lost the hero of the war, because we lost the anointed of God, because it's a national tragedy for the Jewish people, because it's Mashiach Hashem has fallen. Why are we instructing the Benot Yisrael to cry? For all of the above, or for none of the above?
Well, it focuses on the fact that they clothed him in royalty, basically.
Clothed who in royalty?
Shaul.
No, other way around.
When they sang like that David...
We'll come back to that in a second. Oh, okay. Let's just deal with the pshat of the pasuk. It's the other way around.
He dressed you.
Correct.
In shani.
Correct. Mm-hmm. He dressed you in red and in garments of silk and in jewelry of gold upon your clothes. Why?
Because he had so many wives.
Nope. I'm not talking about the wives of Shaul. What are the Benot Yisrael who are crying or should be crying because of the loss of Shaul, who dressed you in and who brought you gold and silver and red garments and silk garments? And what are we describing? Just understand the pshat of the pasuk.
Your life was good for them when he was alive, no?
Something about celebration, that you're all dressed up.
What does it say? Read me the translation.
It just says, O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who would clothe you in scarlet with finery, and who would place golden jewelry upon your clothing.
Right. So when on earth would not Israel be clothed in scarlet and finery and gold jewelry because of the king of Israel?
When he was crowned?
When he was anointed.
When he got married?
Yeah. Thinking too broad, broadly or narrowly. Right.
If they won,
it was after battle.
After battle. Right. What do the warriors of battle bring back?
Booty.
The booty of battle, right? The bounty, the gold and the garments and the clothing and the jewelry and the. Okay, so the gold and silver goes into the treasury, but all the garments of all the women and all the jewelry and all the all that goes to Benot Yisrael, who would naturally and willingly and with joy and with glee greet the returning armies from every battle and every victory. That's how it worked.
It's hard to imagine it, isn't it?
Okay? It's a different world. It's a different world from our world. But that's what it was, right? Look, if the army came back in victory, they would bring all the spoils and they would disperse them amongst the women of the society. That's why the Benot Plishtim are celebrating, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why he turns to Benot Yisrael and he says, okay, Benot Yisrael, now cry. Why?
Because the
one who brought you all the spoils of war is gone. Hamal bishchem shanim adanim, hamale adizahav alivushchem. He's gone, and he's not going to bring you any spoils of war anymore. So cry. Okay. Now, there
That's
is
simplistic.
It's more than simplistic. It's extraordinarily cynical. But it's intentionally cynical.
Because it's very transactional.
But it's very specific.
They're not talking about that they died. They're only worried about that they don't have the
Why?
Body.
Why is David so cynical? So here comes back. Here we come back to what I think is at the core of the answer to your question. Zvi, you asked me why he has such respect for Shaul. Because he never blamed Shaul. He never blamed Shaul. But you know who he did blame?
People who followed him?
Nope.
The women?
The daughters of Israel.
Why?
Women always get to blame.
Right. Because they caused it. They started it.
Wow.
Go back to source. Look at source 13.
That's it.
The day he came back, when he was put into service under Saul's army as the warrior to go to war against the Plishtim, in the very beginning, right after the Battle of Goliath. When they returned from David's fighting the Philistine, referring to Goliath, all the women from the people of Israel, cities of Israel, would come out lashir, to sing, and to dance, to greet, because that was normal. That was the standard routine. But tupim, with simcha, with all kinds of musical instruments, would dance in the streets. And these women who were singing and dancing in the streets the songs of victory, they would sing and they would answer and they would say the following. Saul with his thousands and David with his tens of thousands. Right? Now, and at that point, Shaul gets extraordinarily angry and jealous, etc., and upset. And the result is, all of the years of torment that David goes through because of the jealousy triggered by the songs of Israel, by the songs of the women. And what we never really address, but I think it's absolutely true, is what was their intent? Was their intent to insult Saul and to prefer David to Saul? Or was it just the poetry of Yikat David Ba'alafav, Yishaul Ba'alafav, David B'Livavatav? It never really addresses that question. I think to David, he really felt that they really insulted Shaul. That they really tried to project a preference for a David over Shaul. Maybe they could convince the people. Maybe they, right? That David was the young warrior. David was handsome. David was Yafem, Einai, David was, they were kind of just goggling over David. And Shaul was older generation. Shaul was, you know.
So that was the reason that he was chasing.
And that's what caused the jealousy, right? That's what started Shaul's jealousy, that he thought David was became a threat to him. His protege was now a threat. But the protege was portrayed as a threat by Benot Yisrael. So in the lament of Shaul, he turns to Benot Yisrael and he says, now you're going to cry. Over? All those spoils of war over the years that he brought you, he's no longer going to bring you. You want to play that game? Play that game. I don't think he truly blamed Shaul. I think
doesn't
he truly blamed Benot Yisrael.
That doesn't sound very good for the women.
He was, they in their innocence, I think, but they
innocence,
right? But they really played a critical role in the tragedy of Shmuel Aleph because they triggered, and they continue to trigger. Remember, it was even later on that they by the Plishtim were quoting this song that the women are singing. I told you it was the best-selling, it was the top of the charts on the radio Plishtim, radio KMOX Plishtim, right?
I have a problem with it because it's sort of like, you know, if you tell a mother that their daughter or their son did this mila or that mila, most mothers are not going to be jealous of their offspring. They're going to be happy and proud that their kids are doing well or did something great or whatever.
Correct. A mother
but
will be
that,
proud of a child. But a king, of his son-in-law would be very jealous because his son-in-law is a threat.
Well, and fearful.
Right.
Not just jealous, but fearful.
For sure. A king of his son-in-law, who's more powerful than his son and more powerful than him, would absolutely be seen as a threat. And if you are the Benot, and if your job is to sing the victory songs to the warriors that came back, imagine for a moment, forget everything else, imagine for a moment any society, but even the United States, imagine for a moment if on the airwaves and on the all you heard about was the success of the vice or the second in command over the general, right? And what that means to the general, it would paranoia would set in a heartbeat. That's exactly what happens.
So he feels they didn't use good judgment. They did it for...
I thought it was stupid, but I was, you know, but okay, whatever. I'm not worried about looking for... But David saw that, you know, the irony that the story begins with the Benot Yisrael singing, and the story ends where David says to the Benot Yisrael, now sing, or now cry, over Saul. Right? There's a real target there. And I know it's at 10:30, but if you allow me literally 90 seconds more, I want to come back to one of the most problematic psukim in the Shira, in the Kina, and what I think is the real pshat of this pasuk. Because take a look at Pasuk Chavav. Polemics have been written about this pasuk, I think, unfortunately, tragically. Tsar li alecha achi Yonatan, na'amta li ma'od, my pain to you, my brother Yonatan, sweet to me you were, nifla'ata avatcha li mi'avat nashim. More wondrous to me was your love than the love of women. Now, polemics have been written in the modern era about this pasuk, as if to suggest that there was something unkosher about the relationship between David and Yonatan, which is absolute garbage. But what is, it just doesn't have any context that would bear out in the pshat of Tanakh. But the reference to Avat Nashim here is very telling. What's he talking about?
His wives.
Right? So look at Rabbeinu Yonah. Fascinating. Rabbeinu Yonah in Source 14. Back on that Mishnah about Avasha Tliyabadava. Come to the where it's in bold. Actually, the line before it. And it says, that's why it says in this Hesped al Yonatan, Nifla'ata Avatchali Me'avat Nashim. Klomar, Me'echan Yadati, Shenifla'a Avatchali. How do I know that your love for me was more spiritual and not physical? That's his whole thesis, is that Tliyabadava is physical versus spiritual. Me'avashal Nashim, from the love of women. How do I know? Shikshaya Mishneh Etzu Sha'ul. When David was the second in the general in the army to Shaul, Hayu Omrot Hanashim Hikashu Ba'alafav V'Davi B'Rivivatav V'Shaul Nitkaneh. Because of that song that the women sang, Shaul became jealous. Kanadaz, it's known. Omnam Yonatan Lodai Shalom Nitkaneh La Adraba Yitzilum Yadaviv. Yonatan did not become jealous. Yonatan saved him. So what he's pointing to, an extraordinary suggestion. The Avat Nashim in this pasuk is not a generic love of women, that I loved you more than I love women, or you love me more than love of women. It's not about sexuality. It's about the women he just talked about. Right. Who are the Avat Nashim? All of those women standing on the sidelines as we came back from battle, goggling with their eyes and singing the praise that ultimately led to the tragedy. You, on the other hand, your loyalty, you were more threatened by my success. You should have been, you could have been, more threatened by my success than anybody else, and yet you remained loyal to me. Your loyalty, your love, your devotion, your connection surpassed, was able to rise above the Ahavat Nashim that so destroyed Shaul. And the Avat Nashim in this context is exactly the same, but not Yisrael, that he talked about in Tipsikim earlier. It changed the whole dynamic of the pasuk, dynamic of the end of the Shira, and then he ends with Ech Naflu Giborim Klei Milchama. Yaved. All right, so we're going to stop here. When I kind of went through the Kina pasuk by pasuk, line by line, what I want to do in our last discussion of this parak is look at the overall structure of the Kina and what we can learn specifically about the relationship between David and Shaul from the way in which this Kina is written. There's a whole theory as to the structure of the Kina, which is really a subject to itself and worthy of our discussion.